Palestine, Words Tape Ministry, Queensland. It's now Saturday the 18th of May, 1985. We're at the Queensland University for the Labrie Conference, 1985. This is the first session of the day and is cassette number 8. The title is The Status of Man in the Modern Novel, and the speaker, Donald Drew.
English literature, who's going to talk to us about the status of man in the modern novel.
Welcoming you, but by saying that my thesis this morning is a simple one, but it's not simplistic. There are problems in one sense with it, but I think it stands up very well. And that is that just as, for example, a man like Solzhenitsyn sees communism as making a complete break with the past in the USSR, so it is possible to see Western literature as doing virtually the same. Now, before proceeding any further, I would want to say unequivocally and emphatically that there are some novelists still writing, as it were, in the Western European tradition. Thomas Wolfe was one. Iris Murdoch, John Foulds, Doris Lessing, William Golding, Graham Greene, Angus Wilson, C.P. Snow, Anthony Powell, Saul Bellow. Those men and women, joined by others, are well aware of the human dilemma, and they're honestly seeking to present it and portray it. They write soberly, they write stylishly, and they see through the chaos of contemporary existence. But even though in one sense they vaguely posit a moral universe, even though they do not, they are not aware of the existence of absolute truth in the person of the God of the Bible, and therefore their analysis inevitably falls short because it doesn't take a full or an honest account of the nature of man. Unless we have an awareness of who God is, we can't really know who man is. And although these men and women are so sensitive and compassionate, and they're joined by others, and I wish to say that in view of what you might regard as a devastating attack on English literature in the 20th century for the remainder of this lecture. But if you did so think that I was that what I was giving was purely negative, then please forgive me, I think you would have failed to understand what I'm trying to say. I am going to be critical, but to be critical does not mean to be negative. A critical attitude is not necessarily a negative attitude. It simply means that one is going to take a longer look at something than one is normally in the habit of doing. And that is what I would like to do. Now, I'll have more to say about writers of that quality, whose names I just mentioned, towards the end of the lecture. But my feeling is that, and I'm speaking not only of fiction, but of the novel, if one goes into any large bookshop in any big city, whether one is looking at the colourful paperbacks or whether one is looking at the hardback novels, one is being confronted with a view of man that is incomplete, that is distorted. It doesn't matter if it's incomplete as long as it isn't distorted. I'm not sure that I know that no man can write a complete history of the world. Paul Johnson's marvellous book, Modern Times, which he writes from 1917 to the present day, that's not a complete history because he is unaware, as all of us are unaware, of what's going on in the supernatural realm where history is being reenacted. So you can't write a complete history. Similarly, we can't write a complete novel that tells us everything about man. But we can come to we can come to an analysis of where he is. But if the picture is distorted, then it, as well as incomplete, then we are in trouble. And I would go so far as to say, and I say it carefully, that in my view, two-thirds of the literature that we find in the libraries and in the paperback and in the bookshops have this incomplete or distorted, or this incomplete and distorted view of modern man. There's only about a third of writers, and this perhaps is so in all the areas of the arts, but it has not been so before. When the classicists were writing in the 18th century, and when the romantics were writing in the 19th, so there are problems with the romantics, there was, as it were, a generally accepted view about man. And writers were not producing distorted work. There were the odd one or two, certainly. And there were tracts and little broadsheets, but that's neither here nor there. Now, the portrayal of man that comes through much, and remember that I say much, not all, much modern fiction, is violent and, as I said, distorted. And it exhibits much pain and agony. And it reflects, of course, the thought forms of the day, but it also promotes and advances those thought forms. This is so particularly perhaps with cinema and TV, which reflects like a mirror what's going on in society around us, what people are thinking, what they're doing. But the very fact of reflecting those things and each time pushing them a wee bit further with a bit more language or a bit more violence or a bit more sex or whatever it happens to be, or a few more half-truths or some distorted thinking, that pushes further forward, advances even further forward. And so it is with much literature. And the portrayals that we find, we find in a great deal of modern literature are viewed with a sort of detachment by the authors. I'm thinking not only of paperbacks, but as I've said, of hardback literature that poses, and much of it is fine, but much more of it poses as being compassionate, but this is the one quality perhaps that's lacking. Lovelessness is nearer the mark, because the authors seem to look on dispassionately, morbidly, from a distance, and they are indifferent, and they don't seem to be involved or to intervene in the life of their characters. You get a man like Shakespeare, perhaps it's unfair to pit anybody against Shakespeare, but let's try it. You get a man like Shakespeare who is very much involved with his characters, because he's concerned with good and evil. And he sees men and women as framed in a moral universe. And he knows there's a moral God there. Now, this is not so today. So, consequently, a different picture is bound, inevitably bound to emerge. Well, now, man is always the subject of the novel, even when the writing is about non-humans, such as animals or imaginary beings. Now, each novel doesn't necessarily have a thesis, but it will have a message. Everything has a message. Every lecture has a message. Every newspaper has a message. Every letter that you and I read has a message. But it may not. Each novel may not have a thesis, but it will have a message because it has a premise. And the vast body of literature from the Hebrews to the early 19th century was based on the tacit assumption that there is a God. Now, the present generation of novelists and those writing some time before them are working on the assumption, on the premise, that there is no God, and that generation is very large and admired and influential. Now, it is influential not because of what it says or does not say about God or about man, but because it sees no connection between them. No connection between them. And because the premise is wrong, so will be the resulting thesis. Now, the premise is that this is man's world. The thesis is that he can change morals at will, and he can solve most of his problems. The premise is that reality is what you personally make it. The thesis is that man, qua man, is a piece of machinery, spiritually dead and virtually obsolete. I think it's fair to say, as Arthur Miller has said, the American novelist, that most writers today have given up trying to search out the right way of living. Now, what do we find within the Western literary tradition at its best? I spoke very briefly about that a moment ago. Well, what we find is that man is seen, or is understood to be, a created being with an actual or a potential relationship to his creator. He is marred and he is imperfect, but he is a potential child of God, capable of being redeemed and being reconciled with his creator. Now, through his achievements, he's unable to perfect himself. And when he tries, his fall, through pride, is the theme of tragedy, with a capital T. It's interesting. No, you can't write tragedies today. No writer can write a tragedy today. That's a bold statement. I hope I can justify it if you ask me a question on it. But what I mean is this, that unless you have an awareness, a real awareness of what is evil and where it comes from and what is good, you cannot write tragedy. He's not deterministically fixed, goes this modern view. Goes the Christian, Judaistic Christian Greek view, in any one state or condition, which is a point again illustrated in tragedy. A man can change his mind. In Antony and Cleopatra, Mark Antony, three times at least, and by implication on other occasions, repeatedly says, I must break away from the chain that is binding me. I must break from this queen. He's able to make choices, but modern man doesn't make choices. He drifts into situations. So, man is not portrayed in the great literature of the past as good or bad, but as good and bad. And his struggle isn't between matter and spirit, but between good and evil. Now, his fundamental moral laws are the commands of his creator, not only social contracts between himself and others. He inhabits an orderly, what we would call a moral universe. Now, within the mainstream of today's Western literature, man is viewed as a being who is any or all of the following: a biological accident, which means he's a column of pink protoplasm that responds to stimuli, self-sufficient, ever-progressing, self-perfectible, and morally answerable only to certain social mores or contracts. He inhabits a morally neutral universe, which itself has been created randomly, and he has accepted the theory of the uniformity of natural causes within a closed system. And propelled by the clever and skillful writing of writers like George Bernard Shaw and H.G. Wells, he, as it were, struts through the pages of 20th century fiction and plays. His uniqueness is denied or suppressed. He's part of the uniformity of natural causes in a closed system. There's nothing special about man. He's isolated in a meaningless and even hostile universe, thwarted, frustrated. A fine example of this is Camus' Myrtle in L'Étranger, in The Stranger. You see the same sort of thing in another sense in the latest, in Peter Schaffer's film, Amadeus. Now, modern man, accepting the ill-digested Darwinian, Marxian, and Freudian ideas, believes that because of this, that is chance, determinism, biology, man can become that, alienated, meaningless, rootless. He has no choice but to become that. And Jean-Paul Sartre's play, No Exit, is a seminal statement on exactly that position. A profoundly interesting work that sets the stage, as it were, for a great deal of future writing regarding current beliefs about man. But a truly human view never finds man without choice. It never finds him without choice. Man may suddenly be brought to points of limited choice, but as long as he's a rational man, he still has the choice of yes or no. Perhaps the most serious thing, or one of the most serious things depicted in much contemporary fiction, is the premise of blind, uninterrupted malignancy, meaningless corruption. You see that again in Amadeus. You see it from an historical perspective in The Killing Fields. In comparison, the Judeo-Christian view of man has shaped the thought of the greatest minds, Christian and non-Christian alike, of Western culture throughout its history, and has sharpened the sensitivities to our human condition for all the great masters of English literature. Now, today's secularist writer is similarly the heir, the inheritor of the same view, but he has stripped it of its raison d'etre and its creator. Dorothy Sayers has observed that humanism is always apt to underestimate and to be baffled by the deliberate will to evil. And that's so true, because modern man sees man not as evil, but as alienated. He's separate from other people. Evil doesn't come into it. He may call it evil, but he doesn't mean it as evil in the biblical sense at all. Man is not rebellious against the God who is there. He's ridden and tortured with anxiety. Steinbeck in East of Eden is unable to face the problem of evil. On another level, there is what has been termed an unnatural sentimentality that sometimes occurs in, I quote, realistic controversial fiction and drama. For example, the theme of compassion. Now, contemporary compassion, if we're going to trace that very, very briefly, might be said to have begun with the picaresque characters, the Till Eulenspiegels that we find in 19th century literature. And then, in 20th century literature, it moved into the romanticizing of the comparatively innocuous scallywag. Then it advanced, as we see in Steinbeck's two novels, Sweet Thursday and Tortilla Flat, but he's not the only writer who does this, into the beautiful little people. Then it moves to the shiftless, amoral character, and now we're getting very near our own day, where, if you and I don't love such characters, we're smug and we're hard of heart in comparison to the author's compassion and for such common mortals. Now, perhaps the latest progression is from the lovable bum to the beautiful people. It's to the genial rapist and the jolly slasher, the smooth killer and the fun-loving pusher. And if you doubt that, then consider regarding the traitor and plays like Another Country, and embrace a trilogy of films that have just come out of England, in which it's no exaggeration to say that the traitor is not blamed. It is his environment. He may have a homosexual problem, or he was brought up this or that way, and therefore he has become evil? No. And so he just jollies his way through and becomes a traitor. The Little Drummer Girl has something of the same sort in it. In Bond's play, Edward Bond's play, Saved, still showing in London, that the same ideas come through. Bonnie and Clyde, I suppose, in film, was perhaps the first film to reveal this type of attitude, where you have winsome, apparently attractive and appealing people doing the most appalling things. Now there we see exemplified a technique of identification with the degraded. And it's very easy in reading modern literature to find yourself identifying with the degraded, not because, simply because they're degraded, and then one becomes degraded oneself. One has to separate the degradation and say, well, yes, now this is the result of evil, and I'm in the same boat as this character is. There is hope for this person, but not with this author. Not with this author. He's pushing this man into the dirt. Compassion is the sharing of sorrow, pity, sympathy, the desire to give, the feeling another's plight or pain as if it were yours, and a large and a generous view of life and a distinct standard of values is necessary to be compassionate. To be compassionate does not mean that we suspend judgment. One must be able to discern the difference between a man destroyed by his own fault, his own choices, and a man destroyed for the fault of others, or no fault of his own. And a moral value must be set upon a man's actions and circumstances. One sees how this is, how John Foulds is attempting this in his latest novel, Mantissa. He's attempting to set a moral value upon a man's actions. A taking of sides is incumbent, because compassion is discerning the gap between the man that is and the potential man that was and could be. To understand all is to forgive all, and there but for the grace of God go I. Our statements concerning much of truth about compassion, statements not usually to be seen in our contemporary transposition of values. James Jones' novel, not a modern novel, a few years ago now, From Here to Eternity is one such. Harold Robbins' novels evince the same characteristics. Similarly, soap operas like Dynasty in Dallas. False compassion takes the form of a negation of values and a denial of responsibility. It denies that men and women are what their consistent and voluntary actions make them. And the elements of true tragedy and compassion, which are, of course, a fall from a recognized standard, a loss of self-respect, and a struggle to regain those, are so often missing. Moreover, since some writers' concept of compassion, as Edmund Fuller has observed, will not allow them to blame the criminal and the degraded, they blame the non-criminal and the non-degraded. That is, they blame you and they blame me. If there are no values, one cannot distinguish between the hypocrite from the genuine man. The Uriah Heep from the man of real humility. So there can be no great true literature or vital literature if there is no true understanding of good or evil, and especially if evil itself is ignored or avoided. Perhaps the great depth among the many great depths in the writings of a man like Dostoevsky lies in the fact that he takes sides. We're not aware that he's taking sides because he's a great writer. But he's always conscious of moral dilemmas in human beings. Take the title of one of his novels, Crime and Punishment. And that's exactly the way you and I speak those words when we speak of that novel. We say crime and punishment. But it isn't that at all. It's crime and punishment. You commit a crime, therefore there is punishment. The same is true of Solzhenitsyn, or of a book, again a little old, but it still has a firm reputation, and justly, Alan Paton's Cry the Beloved Country. Now, many of today's novelists present a facet of life as if it were the whole. Phenomena is presented minus evaluation. We cannot say of their attitude towards their characters, to understand everything is to forgive everything. They see much, but they understand little. Many writers don't understand at all because they devalue everything. They don't forgive all. They don't forgive anything. Why? Because there's nothing to forgive. If there is no evil in man, then there's nothing to forgive. He's not guilty. You cannot say of their characters, there but for the grace of God go I, because you cannot find in their work any chain of moral cause and effect by which you could move to where one of their characters is, as we can so clearly with Shakespeare. Thus, the irony is that such writers are not compassionate, but they tend to be vindictive. They're not binders up of wounds. They're destroyers of individuals and of social order. Many of today's obsessional novels are books that at least two of Dostoevsky's brilliantly portrayed characters might themselves have written. In The Brothers Karamazov, we have Ivan Karamazov, who said, and it's such an appallingly true statement, if God is dead, everything is permitted. Aren't those words true as you and I look at our society today? If God is dead, then everything is permitted. And Smerdyakov, his servant, committed murder. Raskolnikov, in Crime and Punishment, saw the moral law as inapplicable to some men, and acting accordingly, he murdered. So, what Dostoevsky is showing us is that ideas are not abstractions. Ideas have consequences. Now, how have we, and may I just briefly at this point, inserting it particularly, especially at this point, how have we arrived at this modern position? Let me very quickly try to sketch the background, this will be very brief indeed, of today's thinking in all areas. I think we may trace this to the Renaissance, but one can't be certain, and one certainly can't, of course, put any date. When the Renaissance began to exalt man over against God, then came the French Revolution, which took that a stage further, exchanging God's revelation for man's enlightenment, and insisting that all men were equal and should enjoy freedom of all kinds, freedom from and freedom of all kinds. Some of the Romantic writers pushed that further, those ideas further. Darwinism, in its turn, suggested that life is the result of chance combinations of matter, thus again reducing man's significance, and incidentally encouraging the belief that science can provide answers to all questions. Then Marx came along and asserted that history makes men and is entirely the result of a conflict between different ways of running an economy. In due course, Lenin seized on those ideas, calling for disruption and division as a means of conquest and enslavement. Then also, at this point, certain theologians began to fillet the backbone of the historical and the supernatural from the Bible, and Freud capped it all by teaching that man is little more than a piece of machinery. Meanwhile, all this time, and in our own time, philosophers have been propounding philosophies that are at the back of all those ideologies, that are alien to the true nature of man, undermining his meaning, his purpose, and his sense of destiny. Modern literature derives from philosophies such as evolution, positivism, determinism, which, in plain terms, means that literature is being sucked into atheism and self-destruction. And it must be said, with due accord being paid to the brilliant minds of men and women made in the image of God, as all philosophers and scientists and all of us are, it must be said gently that all these philosophies and ideas, assumptions, illusions, theories, suppositions, hypotheses, fantasies, and ideologies not only dethrone God, but they enslave man. Another problem with one of today's writers is not so much that of an absence of true values as a continual one of acceptance and rejection of society's shifting values and norms. Many writers have lost not so much a framework of values as a view of the nature of man as he truly is before God. Now, some authors achieved great distinction in that area. Dante, Shakespeare, Bunyan, Swift, Johnson, Scott, George Eliot, Conrad, Kipling, Chesterton, Constance Home, and in our own century. Such men and women continued in that great tradition of Western literature, which is exploring the writer's immemorial theme, namely, the nature of man, the nature of man. And the art of fiction is not what men say or do in rooms or on streets. It isn't the clinical data of the physician or the psychiatrist. These are adjuncts to literature. They're not the stuff, the core of it, or they ought not to be, insofar as they illuminate, certainly they illuminate the interpretation of behavior and events, but it isn't so much the matter of a novel that counts. Of course that's important. I'm not for one moment saying it isn't. Of course that's important. But what is more important is the evaluation that the author helps us to come to, rather like a judge helping to direct a jury without actually telling them to what conclusion they should come. The illumination, the interpretation, he has, if he's been true, that he's placing on his writing. Equally, no areas of human behavior are precluded from use by the artist. But he is an artist, not a clinician, not a statistician. Neither is it the function of the writer to give us an unrelieved series of experiences. The good writer takes all human experience and evaluates it. The great writer does exactly the same, but he is passionately concerned with the subject of evil and of good. For example, consider, Edmund Fuller has pointed this out, what a splendid example we have here. Consider Dostoevsky's famous short story, Stavrogin's Confession. Now, that confession is to the rape by this middle-aged man of a 12-year-old girl. The rape itself is not described. Why should it be? What purpose would be served? Dostoevsky is concerned not to drop these events upon us, unevaluated, and unlike a modern novelist in this situation, who would give us perhaps several pages on the rape itself, what he is concerned to do is to show us a man under the burden of guilt, of real moral guilt. And he shows us also that men are capable of doing such things, that compassion is displayed for them and must be displayed for them as human beings created in the image of God. But at the same time, he shows us no doubt about the outrage, the infamy, the guilt of what this man has done. We are told that man has an immortal soul that is jeopardized by such acts. But this does not preclude either a moral or, a mortal or immortal saving of that soul. Stavrogin himself also, interestingly enough, is insistent on this point. I quote, in the doc he says, to the court, "I am always master of myself when I want to be. And so let it be understood that I do not claim irresponsibility for my crimes, either on account of environment or of disease." That is a far, far cry from modern man allegedly trapped in the determinism of his genes, his psychology, or his environment. The young man who attempted to assassinate President Reagan a few years ago, the immediate plea of the defense lawyers was, "Any man who attempts to assassinate a president is sick." This young man attempted to assassinate the president. Therefore, he is sick. Now, it's frequently considered by numbers of today's writers that a vocabulary of four-letter words, fairly detailed descriptions of undressing, anatomical delineations, and detailed accounts of sexual activities add up to a most profound study of the relationships between men and women. Now, that is tantamount to saying that soap operas represent tragedy, that Dallas is paralleled by Oedipus. We should ask, what does this illumine? What is added to our understanding of character and of life? What is revealed that was not known before? What evaluation does the writer give us? But today, many exhausted writers are searching frantically for novelty and for outrageous shock tactics. Compare Dickens in this respect. For all the Victorian constraint in Dombey and Son, Dickens has achieved a powerful description of an ugly marriage in which all its sexual realities may be understood by the discerning without a word being penned on the subject. But today's writers, so many of them, try to work without any limits. Yet it is in working within limits, as Goethe said, that the craftsman reveals himself. Another ill-defined area in much contemporary fiction is the portrait of woman. Some fine writers in the past have been skilled in this area. You think of Henry James, George Eliot, Hardy, Thackeray, Flaubert, Tolstoy. And one difference, however, in the characterization of women by both male and female writers arises from the secondary or inferior position woman has occupied in some phases of history. But today, we are often presented with a distorted and grotesque portrayal of woman. In James Jones' novels, From Here to Eternity, we get the lovable whore with her alleged understanding of life. We are presented, especially in the paperbacks, but also in the hardback literature, with what are known as sensitive vignettes of lost or unsatisfied older women. The Last Picture Show, the film that delineated that very well. Quivering girls trembling on the edge of sexual maturation. Or the disillusioned divorcee. Or the female Hell's Angel and the voracious lesbian. I'm not condemning those people. They're made in the image of God, as we are. And condemning what the writers are making women into. In all these cases, the relationships, if they can be called that, if they exist at all, are seen as transitory, and often, of course, from a woman's point of view, inferior. Two of the principal facets of sex are the unitive and the procreative, and in the main, today's writer seem ignorant of or ignore these facets, and instead we are often regaled with symptoms or final stages of disordered sexuality, which are then represented as normal. And woman is often seen little more than a Kleenex tissue. By the same token, man's sexuality is viewed as disordered. Love is not understood nor believed in, and the bearing of children as a fulfillment of love is seldom mentioned in modern literature. Interestingly enough, this type of literature, 9/10 of it, is written by men. And in view of this, we should not be surprised, in view of this type of literature, not the fact that it's written by men, we should not be surprised at the influential position occupied by feminist writers who are, in varying degrees, understandably and rightly angry at the treatment accorded many women by many men. And all men should say so. Writers such as Valerie Minor, Alice Walker, Mary Sarton, Marge Piercy, to name only a few, are engaged in seeking, as they would see it, to redress wrongs. But in so doing, not only do they have an untrue view of who woman is before God, but also who man is before God. Moreover, although skillful writers, they are not so much novelists as propagandists dedicated to the militant exploitation of a single issue. Now, literature, as I said at the beginning, is not only a reflector, a mirror reflecting contemporary manners and morals, it is a filament that modifies the sensibility of the age in which we live. Compare the well-mannered and civilized exchanges in Jane Austen's novels with John Osborne's early plays, where one finds passionate contempt for human beings and a certain animalism. We find this in Albee's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, Peter Weiss' Mara Sad. We see it in Howard Brenton's The Roman Play, Romans in Britain, or Edward Bond's play Saved, contemporary plays. And if you go into any large paperback bookshop, you'll see much of what I've been describing, which is making the Western world look so hideous. What I'm getting at this stage in my lecture is a simple, but I think true truth. That there is a bitter line of hostility to modern civilization that is running through much of today's writing, and we find it in the other arts too. Writing of Luis Buñuel, the distinguished Spanish film director, Henry Miller has observed that, I quote, "Either you are crazy, like the rest of civilized humanity, or you are sane and healthy like Buñuel. And if you are sane and healthy, you are an anarchist and throw bombs." Now that's not a one-liner, as it were, off the cuff. That's a profoundly believed philosophy of life that Henry Miller has. Norman Mailer, of whom I'll speak later, openly acknowledges that, I quote, "Whether the life is criminal or not, the decision is to encourage the psychopath within oneself." End of quotation. The current German philosopher Ernst Jünger endorses this and comes to the conclusion that it's better to be criminal than degraded. Now that is propaganda, linguistic terrorism, a formative social force that reflects and promotes current thought forms and lifestyles. So as far as the mainstream of modern literature is concerned, the dominant trend is of an almost total rejection of the civilized past in favor of a search for expression and fulfillment. And that is itself, of course, a reflection of current psychological thinking that emphasizes the primacy of the emotions, that encourages self-esteem, self-worth, self-help, self-fulfillment. Flow with your feelings and keep on flowing with your feelings. With the rejection of the civilized past, frequently goes the rejection of some values that accompanied it, such as courtesy, tolerance, an objective morality, honesty and a sense of honour. The critic George Wellworth insists that the only instinctive desires, by which he means anger, hate, longing, the physical desires, are worthy of consideration by the artist. The terrorist Shen, in André Malraux's novel La Condition Humaine, sneers that the man who has never killed a man is a virgin. Murder as therapy is a theme in Adamov's play L'Encens de la Marche, and in Mailer's novel An American Dream, a man's murder of his wife is presented as a positive act in the development of his personality. In his latest novel, Ancient Evenings, Mailer again reveals his continuous interest in sex of various kinds and perversions and in power. And I think in this novel he reaches rock bottom. As I say, sex of various kinds and perversions occupy more than half the book, a book that I personally find loathsome and pretentious. In its animosity towards cultured, cultural, humane, God-given values. What a far remove is this kind of thing from Dr. Johnson's comment that whatever withdraws us from the power of our senses advances us in the dignity of thinking beings. Mailer is really a very fine writer. He can be such a fine writer. And he illuminates truths with a small t from time to time. But he's always tended to magnify the advantages of power. The delights of sex, not seeing man as anything else, as anything other than a piece of machinery. Another contemporary novelist of both skill and influence is Joseph Heller, Catch 22. He's a fine writer, but his latest novel, God Knows, which has King David of the Bible as the central character, is not so much irreverent, it's more blasphemous than irreverent. It's not so much wise as clever. Indeed, wisdom and understanding is full of very funny things. I mean, you laugh your head off again and again. But there's no wisdom there. Indeed, wisdom and understanding are usually at a premium when speaking of modern literature. One might describe God Knows as a guided tour by the Red Queen round a vast canvas by Hieronymus Bosch. Now, I've alluded to these two writers because if a distinction may be made between a fiction writer and a novelist, if one may be made, then they're novelists. But writing in a manner that undermines proven values and pushes further in the direction of selfism, of anything goes, then if anything goes, we get to the position, where's the apparent ultimate of anything goes philosophy today? You find it in the punks in England. Boys and girls, as much made in God's image as each one of us, and let us not judge them. Perhaps we've got to think more deeply than that, much more deeply, and always compassionately of them. But there's the ultimate in selfism. Anything goes. History begins and ends with me, which is what the punk is saying. Nothing is of any significance before this point. Two other contemporary novelists, John Foales, Doris Lessing, reveal less confusion about the human condition, and their books are rich in imagery and sure in dialogue, and always profound characterization. Great joy to read. Mantissa and Canopus in Argos Archives, respectively, these novels disclose an awareness of what should be the relationship between men and women, even though they're very strong on alienation. There's no sense of sin. But these novelists are powerless to present the truth about mankind and the nature of reality. And to them should be added those other novelists I mentioned at the beginning. Thus, in modern literature, there's a confusion, as there is in all other areas. Old-fashioned humanists, if one may call them that, like Foales and Lessing and Golding, are matched by novelists like Mailer and Heller, who are subversive and anti-civilization in many of their attitudes. Moreover, so much contemporary literature is self-conscious, self-reflecting, often given to projecting the writer's neuroses onto his readers. Thus, to encapsulate 300 years of man as the measure of all things philosophy, news of God's death has secularized and altered all aspects of Western man's thought and life. One of today's major philosophies, existentialism, has much influenced thinking and writing with its belief in a random and purposeless universe. Is it any wonder, then, that we had, and that we still have, a theatre of the absurd and a theatre of cruelty? Ionesco's Rhinoceros and Beckett's Endgame. Man in Beckett's plays or Mailer's novels is a victim. He's a victim. Many of today's writers, as I've said, use shock tactics, and they're orientated towards hopelessness and spiritual death. Now, that has never, never happened in the history of literature before. The Romantics, for example, rejected the neoclassicism of writers like Pope and Dryden, but it was a literary tradition that they rejected. It was not culture itself. Today's avant-garde reject even society itself. As I say, it's a sort of cultural guerrilla group, owing allegiance to no one, and contemptuous of civilization and of civilized behavior. There's much in modern civilization to be contemptuous of. May I be the first to say so. But to reject it all, this is another matter. Literature, directly or indirectly, has been one of the greatest forces shaping human history. And the Western tradition, throughout the centuries of the greatest world literature, is seeking to illuminate man, throw light on man in his human dilemma, and to diagnose man's ills, and to help him raise his sights, as on a rifle, to raise his sights higher, not lower, and not to strip him naked or defenseless. You recall Chaucer's Gentle Irony, all dealing with man, Shakespeare's exposure of good and evil in man, Milton's analysis of man's fallenness, Swift's satire on his pretensions, Jane Austen's Honest Irony, and Dickens' Compassion. In the writings of all these, as of others, among many others, man is never driven into a corner. He's often cut down to size, but not belittled, not clinically analysed nor anatomised, not shown as less a man, but faithfully shown what he becomes when he fails to act as he knows a man should act, and always framed in a moral universe. Dr. Johnson asked, what is the use of books if they are not to teach us how to live? Matthew Arnold believed that the best literature has a power of forming, sustaining, and delighting us. And he defined literature as a criticism of life. But, as I've tried to show, there is missing the sense of a serious responsibility to the public among many of today's writers. Camus observed that, and Solzhenitsyn has made a similar comment, as has Marshall McLuhan. Camus observed that, I quote, we all carry within us our places of exile, our crimes, and our ravages. But our task is not to unleash them onto the world, it is to fight them in ourselves and in others. And those are sentiments with which I would, as a Christian, agree, and as a human being. The Western literature tradition for 300 years has sought to entertain and to sustain man. It has helped to bring the diverse and sometimes perplexing thoughts and experiences about life into an ordered unity, so that what was apprehended about man and the external world could be comprehended. It was a momentary stay against confusion, a buffer against barbarism, an illuminator of ignorance. In turn, it did require something of a cultivated response on the reader's part. Now, line those criteria up against Burroughs' The Naked Lunch, or, it's hardly fair, but I'll just mention it, Playboy magazine, or Tom Wolfe's The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. It's a bit old now, but the principle is the same. Pinter's plays. Yes, they give us illumination, of course they do. But they downgrade man and they belittle man. And what makes so much of this sort of writing both trivial and pernicious is that the writers make literature self-sufficient, an end in itself, self-existent. C.S. Lewis was so right when he said that all the greatest writing is done by men and women who valued something else much more than literature. Modern writing exhibits the poison of subjectivism. And there are several assumptions are made in all this literature. First, because God is dead, everything is allowed. And that eventually means that there's no objective truth. And if there's no objective truth, then there is no morality that we can be sure of and no normality. Thus, the authentic self becomes primitive and anarchic. There's nothing to hold it, no boundaries apart from society's elastic norms. And it should be remembered also that the arts in general fulfill a twofold role. They reflect social and cultural thought forms and lifestyles, but they also, as I keep on saying, advance and keep on pushing the boundaries further and further away. Operating on the basis of man's meaninglessness and depicting man as lower, not so much as lower than the angels, but as lower than the animals, orientated towards spiritual death and hopelessness, there are no answers. There are no answers. Then what future is being promoted by many of today's writers and thinkers? Solzhenitsyn has written that, I quote, by intuition and by his singular vision of the world, A writer is able to discover far earlier than most people aspects of social life and can often see them from an unexpected angle. It's incumbent on the writer, therefore, to inform society of all that he is able to perceive, and especially all that is unhealthy and cause for anxiety. So literature, as I've said, used to be a buffer against barbarism, but it no longer serves their purpose, because in the first place, it cannot do so. It can, to some extent, prevent, and it can help to prevent the destruction of the best in man and in this life. But, of course, the most it can do is, as Lewis put it, it can bring man to the gates of the heavenly Jerusalem, but it cannot get him inside them. Only by repentance and faith in the free grace of the living God through Christ can man be redeemed and that image of God be restored. I. A. Richards, a most distinguished literary critic, who does not speak as a Christian, understands this very well when he writes, I quote, "When a created, simple, and eternal soul was the pivotal point, good was conformity with the will of the Creator. Evil was rebellion. But when the associationist psychologists substituted a swarm of sensations and images for the soul, good became pleasure, and evil became pain." Let us remember what so many modern writers seem to have forgotten. As Lewis said, the really great literature is possible only by men who know there is something greater than literature. And the final frivolity, the ultimate vacuity, is art for art's sake, self-sufficient, self-authenticating, to be valued only because it exists. That is idolatry. Because idolatry is not only worshipping a graven image, but making anything else, anything less than deity, absolute. What can literature do against the merciless onslaught of the lie, of becoming a slave to silly little progressive ideas? The answer is, it must tell the truth about man, the universe in which he lives, and God. A Russian proverb well expresses it. One word of truth is of more weight than all the rest of the world. And this is where we now are. I come in my conclusion with man-made values as the norm. And consequently, materialism and commercialism gobbling up idealism and softening up our moral fiber. The will to take sides, yes or no, right or wrong. The will to resist all agencies from whichever side they come that would encroach, erode, and trample on man as made in the image of God. In the biblical worldview, one observes, as Lewis said, this thing, I quote, "In the biblical worldview is the doctrine of objective value, the belief that certain ideas are really true and other ideas really false to the kind of thing that the universe is and the kind of beings that we are." And as we consider the universe and ourselves, we're led to one strong conclusion. The way things are and the way man is are fully corroborated and confirmed in Scripture. Because the world created by God is rational, the study of it has meaning, and life within it has meaning. The Bible underlines the truth of what we already know from the created world around us. And this is so because the Bible contains communicable truth about God and his relationship to his creation. So therefore, we may expect answers to our questions. A Christian is talking sense. And he's speaking of matters as they are when he has that basis for considering man in modern literature. And with the barbarians, as it were, at the gates, it's his privilege and his responsibility to write and to study and to think and to question, to cry, to pray, and to love, to judge only what is written, not the writer. To judge only what is written, not the writer. To sing and dance and write and clean and bake and teach and act and compose and paint and sculpt and design and preach. And to go on doing these things because of God's sub-creativity within him. Frequently to be shocked, but never to be surprised at what he reads, hears, or sees. Now it's against that fractured, that distorted cultural reality that the Christian, with concern, with courage, sort of courage Solzhenitsyn shows, compassion, has to stand his ground as he lovingly goes on creating beauty and truth. He has to stand his ground, and having done all that the crisis demands, he still has to confront modern man. The student has to confront his fellow student. The housewife has to confront her next door neighbor. Confronting does not mean what we see so often on television, when you have two groups of people, minors or whoever they may be, fighting one another or fighting the police. That is confrontation, yes, but it's of a different kind. I don't mean that. I'm sure you know what I mean. We've got to confront and make people lovingly, seeing them as human beings and treating them as human beings, never pushing them into a corner, but talking to them, confronting them, making them face up to the truth. And this is done as we ourselves show some of the things. We go on creating, go on being sub-creators. We go on writing. Your writing may never be published. You and your family may be the only people and a few friends who read what you have written. But you have made a statement. You've made a difference, if only to their lives. Right, thank you. I will endeavour to answer your questions, if you have any. Thank you. Yes, I see what you're saying. I don't think I disagree with that. I think that's a good point. Nietzsche, of course, Nietzsche was had this idea of, had these two ideas running concurrently, it seems to me, the will to power in man and his corresponding ability presumably to achieve all that, but then that implied the death of God, and the death of God is spelled out so clearly in his writings. But if I've understood you correctly, which I hope I have, if one wants to see a picture of what the fall has done to man on our current television screens, for example, perhaps the best picture that we could possibly look at would be Dallas. There one sees the fall, the results of the fall in all its appalling consequences. There is the sheer selfishness and the lust to power and greed for money and so on. It's a marvelous illustration of, and in that sense, of the fall. And therefore, in that sense, there's a real helping forward. One can use that as an illustration when one's talking. This is what you were suggesting, was talking with your contemporaries. That's right, and it's very interesting to see how these little, as the poet puts it, as the hymn writer puts it, these philosophies have their day. They have their day and cease to be. I mean, existentialism is as it were old hat now. Humanism always has been, but it's no longer a tenable philosophy. And look where the thruster is, look where it has taken us, in international affairs and in personal life. Yes, that's absolutely right. Thank you. Anybody else? Do we have any budding writers here? Oh, we have, yes.
Now, could you just make a specific comment on the place of man in science fiction novels, recent science fiction novels?
No, I'm sorry, I can't. I've read Lewis's three so-called space trilogy novels, of course, and reread them many times. Those are fine. And I've read them all in Narnia and what have you. But I've said to myself, life is too short. That's not supposed to be a smug remark. It's not intended to be taken that way. Please don't take it that way. But life is too short. There is so much to read. And the long and the short of it is, I've read a Robert Heinlein years ago and an Arthur Clarke. And I should probably save myself, all being well, some time by going to see 2010. I'm not belittling your question. I'm just saying I haven't read and I just haven't had the time. Neither has it interested me. But then a lot of literature doesn't interest me that I have to read. But I haven't read it. Would you care to make any more statement on that that would help these good folk? Yes, another area, I'll disarm myself before you, another area that I know nothing about is children's literature. And at Sydney, I had a hard time, and they gave me a rough time over that. They were very, very kind, very, very kind, but they implied that I ought to know something about children's literature, and they're absolutely right. And then there's the problem of time. And I just haven't got into modern children's literature, bad and good. Anything else?
Are there any contemporary Christian novelists that you would particularly recommend to us?
Well, I'd like to put it this way. I get just a little bothered when people talk about Christian films and Christian novels. I'm much more happy and relieved to hear them talking about, well, this is a good novel and it's written by a Christian. I'd rather it was written well. If I had the choice between being operated on in the operating theatre between a really skillful surgeon and and a Christian who wasn't so skillful, I know exactly what you mean. And there are some good writers, some of them Australians. There's Tim Winton. Tim Winton, who comes from Perth, he's had two good novels published. Has anybody read any of Tim Winton's work? Good. I haven't had the pleasure of reading them, but he writes from a biblical worldview. Yes, Tim Winton. Andrew Lansdowne is a poet, an Australian poet. There's another man I was told about. But then in America, there's half a dozen men under their 40s who are writing from a biblical perspective, and if you'd like their names, I'll give them to you afterwards. Then, of course, you've got a whole lot of people like Anthony Burgess, John Updike, Flannery O'Connor, bless her, she's dead, yes, but a whole lot of people who've been writing from either from a religious or a specifically Christian worldview. John Updike, maybe that surprises you, but if you've read Couples, you wonder how on earth he comes into a Christian category. But he's telling the truth. That's the way life is in Ipswich, in Massachusetts. And I've seen him on television and on the radio, and he makes very definite commitments to the God of the Bible, not just to God. He's quite explicit about it. Yes?
And just following the same vein, then, the great need for our students in the tertiary levels in Australia, we don't have a specific Christian college at this stage, or tools or resource material to help in the study of literature. And my question there goes to the last one, you know, in terms of critics or just resource works that can help students to analyse or critique literature, because the system of teaching has changed so much even in 20 years, where a lot of the classics, quote-unquote, a lot of the older authors you've mentioned today were taught more thoroughly. Today there tends to be such a mishmash of material presented as literature, quote-unquote, and it's often difficulty in critiquing it, in knowing what is good literature. The type of questions you mentioned before, what should be asked to judge a book, what's the writer saying, what's his answer to man's problem or whatever. Other than coming to conference like this and hear yourself speak, are there other critics or works available, resources available?
May I answer that second part in a moment? Any student, any undergraduate going through an English course at almost any university in the Western world, that of course includes Australia, is bound to be studying, spending a great deal of time on structuralism. Now, there's no question about it that to understand something of seismotics and structuralism is important. The way in which writers assemble their work and structure a novel and the ideas, the playing about with words and so on. It's all very, very important. There's no question about that. But then that becomes an end in itself, becomes a sort of philosophy. Indeed, it is a philosophy. Men like Colin McCabe, a structuralist, he's exalted the whole thing, borrowing ideas from Marx and elsewhere, into a philosophy of life, as well as the whole thrust of your teaching. Another problem that anybody going into studying English literature, or for that matter history, of course, 9/10 of your professors will be teaching from a humanist, it will be filtered through humanist grids. And in America, the situation is really serious, at least I think it is, because in an increasing number of universities and private and public, the English literature course consists of a third of the course up between a third and a half is literature in the past, and either more than a half or good half is modern literature. So gradually, modern ideas are being filtered through modern philosophies and assumptions and ideologies, and the point is the criteria by which you may judge the quality or the content is being squeezed out. If you're going to measure if we want to know how tall we are, we put our backs against the wall, and there we see the inches and the feet behind us. There's got to be some criteria by which we may assess this, and these are being squeezed out. Now there is. Were you asking me, as it were, for a list of books or writers that would help in this area?
Yes.
Well, I can give you some, and perhaps the best thing to do would be to ask Dr. Ravenscroft, Peter. I'll ask him this. At Sydney, lots of people wanted a list of books, and if anybody wants, we could have a sheet of paper out there, and it would be a subjective list. It would be my list for what help it would be, but I'll do that with pleasure. And then I can send it from Switzerland and it can be duplicated here and sent to you.
I'd just like to hear what you had to say about William Golding. I taught my grade 11's Lord of the Flies this year, and that was great. A lot of things came out of that.
Yes. There's a man who apparently really understands where civilization is going, but cannot bring himself, so it seems to me, he cannot bring himself, although he gets so close to it, in Darkness Visible, in the last novel but one, and then that tremendous novel that he writes in the style of an 18th century novel about a chaplain on board an 18th century man of war. I forget the title of it. A superb book. Similarly, The Inheritors, The Spire, he's reaching forward all the time towards this elusive biblical position, but he never commits himself, he never gets there. The Spire in particular is a clear indication, but it's also a clear indication of something else, man's soaring pride, and so on. See, the symbols are ambivalent, but he really is. I sent him a copy years ago of The God Who Is There by Dr. Schaefer, because I gave some lectures on him, and I hope he read it. But he really does understand, and the statements that he makes from time to time to the press, the statements that he was making around the time of the giving of the Nobel Award last year, although not in the actual lecture itself, were statements again indicating his moving towards. He won't commit himself, and I think it is because he does not see Christianity as being able to stand up in the marketplace of men's ideas. He does not consider it respectable. It's not, if you like, intellectual enough. There are certain well-known distinguished personalities, people in various medical fields in Australia, who were invited to debate with Richard Winter and Jerome and Udo, but they declined. And here, during these conferences, the reason they declined, the reason that they gave, rather, the reason they gave for declining, was that we haven't time to debate with Christians. The assumption being that Christianity just cannot stand up. It's purely a matter of subjective faith. And that's so sad, and that's why why all you dear people come to these conferences, to get some understanding, and for all of us to understand and support and help one another in showing that that is a lie. But back to Golding. He's great. Did the children enjoy it? Boys and girls enjoy it? And there, of course, he's talking about civilization, the savior of civilization, the battleship, coming along. And, no, there's some wonderful stuff in that. Wonderful stuff. I'm sure you are, and you'd speak for others in that area. Again, I know nothing about children's literature, but I do know this, that television has, as it were, a lot to answer for. There's a lot that's good in TV. We may enjoy it together as a family and as individuals. Important things there we may even learn, but be entertained by. But it, as every teacher knows, it helps to destroy or stifle, at least, a child's imagination, a young person's imagination. It makes it more difficult. The stuff they start writing about, the essays they start writing about, will include pictures, will be stuff they've seen on TV. It won't come out of their own imagination. And one of the ways, I know it's right and it's good to encourage children to read, that is right, but if they don't see us reading, see our reading, they won't be very impressed by the advice we give them. It's rather like the teenagers who say, well, don't tell me to come off drugs, Dad. You're smoking or you're drinking. And they've got to see a good example there. But even more cogent than that is the fact that the family itself, I was delighted to have some friends of mine, I hope there'll be friends of mine here, who read as a family. And that's the thing. Father will read, mother will read, or the children will take turns reading this, and they'll go through Lewis's Narnia stories. And then they'll watch television together and criticize that and talk about it and discuss the issues being presented. But to read as a family, as though there was no such thing as Polyphemus, the one-eyed monster, television. Just read as a family. Read as a family. And ask your children, well, what have you done today? What's this book? What's this book you're reading? And instead of expressing horror at, because there's some dreadful stuff I'm told about children to read, and you read that book yourself. And then you are in a position to help that child to analyze it and say, yes, I've read it and I understand it, but This is jolly good, but what about this? Now, is that really true? What do you think about that? Parents have to be, or must be perhaps, much more involved in their children's education than they were before. Because of the nature of what goes on in schools, what's being taught to children that is untrue. Whether Christian schools are the answer or not, as the gentleman over there was perhaps suggesting, I have an open mind on that. The doors have been flung wide open, which is a clear indication that we should go through them. Thank you very much. Right, thank you.